such a great song. Thanks for leading that, Steve. First time I heard that song was in an auditorium at a church in Michigan. The auditorium was designed for about 600 people, and they had about 850 in there. And they all liked to sing, and they sang that song really, really well, and it was really well done. Okay, that was for free, cost you nothing. How are you doing on your daily Bible reading? All of you who are current or reasonably so, signify, that's great. We finished the book of Nehemiah this past week, and I love the book of Nehemiah for a lot of reasons. But let me start out by telling you a story. In 356 B.C., 356 years before Jesus, a young man named Herostratus set fire to the temple of Diana in Ephesus and burned it to the ground. And far from trying to get away, he bragged about what he'd done because he wanted at all costs to be remembered. And so they executed him for the arson, but they also issued a decree that on pain of death, no person in Ephesus would ever say that man's name. Another historian recorded the name for us, so he got his wish anyway. We know that it was a guy named Herostratus that had done that. I think everybody wants distinction in some way or other. This guy wanted fame at any price. And I think that same attitude helps to describe a whole lot of our celebrities. You know, they want fame at any price. They'll do anything to get their names and faces in front of people. What kind of legacy do you want to leave? As you exit this earth, how do you want people to remember you and think about you? John Quincy Adams was our sixth president, but he was also a senator. He was an ambassador for the United States. He was Secretary of State of the United States. He was President of the United States. And after he was president, he was elected six terms as the representative of his home district in Massachusetts to the House of Representatives. And that's what he wanted to be remembered for. He wanted to be remembered for 18 years' service in the House of Representatives. He actually died on the floor of the House of Representatives, I believe. He had a stroke and died there. In our daily Bible reading, we finished the book of Nehemiah, which I think is one of the most interesting Old Testament books, and it has been terrifically influential in the Restoration Movement. I want you to go with me to the very last chapter of Nehemiah, because in Nehemiah 13, Nehemiah says what he wants to be remembered for. He tells us what things have been most important in his life. Now, Nehemiah was a very, very powerful man. He was cupbearer to the king of Persia at a time when the empire of Persia stretched from India to Greece. And to be cupbearer to the king was not just a table waiter. It was a very, very trusted and influential position of advice. He was an advisor to the king. And one guy that I read suggested that you only got this position by being a boyhood friend to the king. So they grew up together, essentially, apparently. They grew up together, he and the king did. The thing that Nehemiah wanted to be remembered for was connected to God, though, and not government. He didn't want to be remembered for all of his political advice. He didn't want to be remembered for his power and status in the government. He wanted to be remembered for his activity for God. And so this last chapter in Nehemiah is kind of an illustration of everything that drove Nehemiah, what really propelled him. Three times he pleaded with God to remember him for what he's done. And he shows us in this chapter the kind of remembrance that I think we all should desire. See, Nehemiah wanted to be remembered, number one, for being faithful and zealous for God. No matter what else, he wanted to be remembered for being faithful and zealous for God. Let's read the first 14 verses of Nehemiah 13. Start with me in verse 1, if you would. Now, I got to set this up a little bit. Nehemiah has enacted incredible reforms, including building the wall around Jerusalem that had been knocked down by the Babylonians long time before. By the way, I saw on the web today, I don't know if anyone else has seen this, some archaeologists in Israel have declared that they have found the wall that Nehemiah built. For a long time, some of the archaeologists said it never happened, this is just a myth. There probably was a guy named Nehemiah, but there's no building activity like this that went on. Now they've found a portion of the wall that Nehemiah built, and they've dated it very successfully because of some of the artifacts they found at the bottom of the wall. So, I don't know if you've heard about that. I just find that stuff fascinating. Nevertheless, Nehemiah has done amazing work. He has brought back some exiles. He has helped to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. Did that in 52 days. Secured the city against its enemies. Enacted a lot of reforms within the city. And then he had to go back, because he really was a trusted advisor to the king. He had to go back to Susa, the capital, 800, 900 miles away. So he did that. He's gone for quite a while, and he has come back now. He's come back. On that day, the reforms are going on. He says, on that day the book of Moses was read aloud in the hearing of the people, and it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever be admitted into the assembly of God, because they had not met the Israelites with food and water, but had hired Balaam to call down a curse on them. Our God, however, turned the curse into a blessing. When the people heard this law, they excluded from Israel all who were of foreign descent. Before this, Eliashib, the priest, had been put in charge of the storerooms of the house of our God. He was closely associated with Tobiah. If you've read Nehemiah, you know that Tobiah is a bad guy. Tobiah the Ammonite. Let's see, they're not supposed to. Well, anyway. And he had provided him with a large room formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine, and oil prescribed for the Levites, singers, and gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. But while all this was going on, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Sometime later, I asked his permission and came back to Jerusalem. Here I learned about the evil thing Eliashib had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. I was greatly displeased and threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I gave orders to purify the rooms, and I put back into them the equipment of the house of God with the grain offerings and the incense. I also learned that the portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and singers responsible for the service had gone back to their own fields. So I rebuked the officials and asked them, "Why is the house of God neglected?" Then I called them together and stationed them at their posts. All Judah brought the tithes of grain, new wine, and oil into the storerooms. I put Shelemiah, the priest, Zadok the scribe, and a Levite named Pedaiah in charge of the storerooms, and made Hanan, son of Zakur, the son of Mattaniah, their assistant, because these men were considered trustworthy. They were made responsible for distributing the supplies to their brothers. Remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. Nehemiah had led reforms earlier to bring these people to dedicate themselves to the covenant. And if you go back and read earlier chapters, he got them all together and he made them sign a pledge, because, you know, that can be really effective. You get them to put their names to it, and we've got their names now in Scripture because these people signed it and put their names to this pledge and said, among other things, we will not neglect the house of our God. Put their names right there on the document. So Nehemiah has to go away. He comes back after a little while, and what have they done? They have neglected the house of God. They've left the vision of this restoration entirely. We have a heritage in our background of zealous service for Christ. When I read the early church fathers, which is not as much as I should, I enjoy that, I should read more of it. But when I read it, it makes me feel incredibly shallow in my faith. I read the way these guys talked and what they did, and I'm talking about in the second and third centuries and beyond the close of the New Testament. It just makes me feel so incredibly shallow. We think about all the legacy of those who have gone before us and done heroic things to bring about the Church of Jesus Christ. We've got heroic preachers that have gone out with no compensation and no hope, really, at all, no knowledge of what tomorrow would bring, whether they would eat or not. They went out and preached and taught and went from town to town and planted churches and helped people grow and develop. We have this heroic legacy, And most of these people's names have been utterly lost to us in history. I had to do a research project when we were living in Michigan, and I did the research project about a church in Missouri, a little bitty country church in Missouri. And I talked to some of the people who were connected with that church, and they talked about one of the founding elders of that church was a man named Hiram Warner, or Warner. They weren't real sure how it was spelled. He wasn't real sure how it was spelled. Hiram Warner. Born in the early 1800s, he died in 1862. They called him that old man Warner. Oh, they loved that old man Warner. He was such a good man, and he preached, and he planted six different congregations in that northwest corner of Missouri. In 1934, he died in 1862. In 1934, the local newspaper did an article about him and his lasting influence in that part of the country. And one of the elders that I talked to at that church said he remembered his father talking about that good old man Warner, that old man Warner. I found the guy's tombstone out in the cemetery. That old man Warner died when he's 52 years old. That don't seem all that old to me. I don't know about you. That old man Warner. But see, look at what a tremendous influence he had in a relatively short time. So, many, many years later, long after anyone who knew him was dead, they still talked about the wonderful influence that he had. There's people like that that have had tremendous impact in our brotherhood. They have been faithful and they've been zealous for God. Now, the question that we kind of have to ask ourselves is this the legacy that we want for ourselves? Do we want to be known for being zealous and faithful to God? I'll tell you that that only comes with dedicated service. I don't suppose at any time in his lifetime people stood up and applauded for that old man Warner. I don't guess anybody ever did that. They probably never told him how much they appreciated his service. They may not have known how much they appreciated his service. It wasn't long years later that they began to realize what a tremendous impact someone like that had. Do we want to be known for being zealous and faithful in our service to God like Nehemiah was? We need the vision and the conviction in our lives that this is the most important thing there is to us. This service of God, this way of life in Christ, this family of God that we're connected to. We need to have the vision and conviction that this is the most important thing that there is. And never, ever forget that the Son of God died for this. During the time of Henry VIII, the Archbishop of Canterbury was a guy named Thomas Cranmer. In 1556, he died. And as he lay dying, he had helped Henry break away from the Roman Catholic Church and start the Church of England, which is very much the same. And he was very dishonest in his dealings with quite a number of people, connived at the death of some influential people. And as he lay dying, Thomas Cranmer lay dying, someone heard him say, "Had I but served my God with half the zeal I serve my King, I should not now be afraid to face him in judgment." I don't know what the most important thing in life may be for you. I hope it's the Lord and His service. But I can't really think of anything more tragic than laying on a deathbed and saying, "I did it all wrong. I had all my focus was misdirected." If anybody remembers me after I'm gone, if anybody does, it'd be very unusual, but if anybody remembers me after I'm gone, I'd like to be remembered for faithful and zealous service for God. I really can't think of a better epitaph that I'd like to have. Nehemiah wanted to be remembered for his faithful and zealous service for God. And he also wanted to be remembered for being absolutely uncompromising in his obedience to God. Pick it up with me in verse 15. We're going to read down through verse 22. Just listen to how this guy conducts himself. In those days, I saw men in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys together with wine, grapes, figs, all other kinds of loads. They were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Therefore, I warned them against selling food on that day. Men from Tyre who lived in Jerusalem were bringing in fish and all kinds of merchandise and selling them in Jerusalem on the Sabbath to the people of Judah. I rebuked the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this wicked thing you were doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Didn't your forefathers do the same things so that our God brought all this calamity upon us and upon this city? Now you're stirring up more wrath against Israel by desecrating the Sabbath." When evening shadows fell on the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I ordered the doors to be shut and not opened until the Sabbath was over. I stationed some of my own men at the gates so that no load could be brought in on the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the merchants and sellers of all kinds of goods spent the night outside Jerusalem. But I warned them and said, "Why do you spend the night by the wall? If you do this again, I will lay hands on you." From that time on, they no longer came on the Sabbath. Then I commanded the Levites to purify themselves and go guard the gates in order to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember me for this also, O my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love. You know, it's one thing to insist that the Jews obey the Sabbath. That's their law. That's their covenant. That's what they had signed the pledge to do. One thing to insist that the Jews do it. Something else to insist that the Gentiles do it too. And Nehemiah insisted this applies to everybody in this town. You come to Jerusalem, you're keeping the Sabbath. All the Gentiles are going to have to keep the Sabbath too. And then what's fascinating is he started out by stationing his own men, the men loyal to him, stationed them at the gates. Then he commanded the Levites, who has the most interest in keeping the Sabbath? It's the Levites. That's their job. Their whole livelihood depends on it. So he made them purify themselves and made them the guards at the gate. Now you guys who are most interested in keeping this correctly, you get out there and do it. And they did it. That also, I'm sure, happened while Nehemiah was gone. There was undoubtedly a lot of pressure for these people to moderate their convictions. Oh, you know, if you Jews want to keep the Sabbath, that's okay. But look, we're not Jews. We come from Tyre, way up in Lebanon. You can't force us to keep the covenant. I mean, you can't reasonably expect us to do that too. We always face pressure to modify our convictions. It's amazing that our opponents never seem to feel the need to modify their convictions. But we're always called upon to modify our convictions. So we hear these calls now to introduce instruments of music into worship. Don't be so unreasonable, people! You know, modify your convictions a little bit. Oh, you can just compromise. That's not a big deal. Sometimes the pressure to moderate our convictions is very, very subtle. And if we're not paying attention, we can compromise our beliefs without even realizing we've done it. I'll give you an example. And this is kind of current to today, too. How many of you have seen the guys with the little red kettles and the bells ringing out there? You got them out there? There's little red kettles and they're ringing the bells. You know who they are? They are a religious group that preaches a gospel other than the one revealed in the New Testament. Now, a lot of people look at them and they say, well, they do a lot of good humanitarian works, and that is true. I freely admit that. But if you put money in those kettles, you're not providing funding for humanitarian works. You are propagating a false religion. I can't do that. I cannot support a church that is not the church of the Lord Jesus Christ, and I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to give any money to the red kettles because they preach a gospel other than the one that's in the Bible. But see, people want to be generous, particularly at this time of the year, and they see that they do great, good humanitarian works, and so they think, well, I'm going to give some money for these humanitarian works. What you're doing is propagating a false teaching. Sometimes the pressure is very subtle that way. Sometimes the pressure is very overt. Sometimes very powerful. Most of you, I think, remember that 25 years or so ago, 30 years ago maybe now, church in Oklahoma disciplined a woman, disfellowshipped a woman from the church, and she sued and collected a large sum of money from that. And from that day, church discipline died in churches of Christ. I dare say there are not many elderships now that will take a direct line on church discipline within the church out of a very reasonable fear of litigation that may occur. And they've had some seminars on how to deal with this, but for the most part, I think it is true that elderships in churches of Christ do not do church discipline now. They may do some things on the side and in the quiet, but the church as a whole never hears about anything like that. So there's pressure to conform, pressure to moderate our convictions. We need to be steadfast. We don't need to be mean. We need to be steadfast, but not mean. We need to be committed to the fact that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Now, we need to do that without despising other people. We're not going to give up baptism for the forgiveness of sins. We're not going to be moderate in our convictions about that. We're not going to be moderate about worshiping the Lord in our singing, doing it properly, in our praying, doing it properly, in our giving, doing it properly. We're not going to moderate our convictions on those things. We're not going to moderate convictions about the power and strength of Scripture. We're not going to moderate that stuff. We will do it with gentleness and respect, as we are urged to do by Peter in 1 Peter 3:15. We need to do it with gentleness and respect. We need not to moderate our convictions. On April 15, 1912, the Titanic sank and killed over 1,500 people. And for a long time, it was assumed that when she ran into that iceberg, it just ripped the hull right out of her. But when they found the wreck and actually started taking photographs, they realized that what had happened was the ship had struck a glancing blow against that iceberg, and it opened up six relatively small slits in the side of the hull. If it had only opened four, the ship almost certainly would have survived. If it had opened up five, she might have survived. When they got that sixth one in there, she couldn't hold together. Watertight integrity was destroyed, and she sank, killed 1,500 people. So that's the way our integrity dies. It dies the death of a thousand cuts. Little cuts, little slits ruin our integrity, and we make shipwreck of our faith. It's generally not some big calamity. It's a number of little wounds that we experienced over and over and over and moderated our convictions bit by bit by bit. Nehemiah wasn't a guy who was going to do that. Nehemiah was not moderate in his convictions. He was very strong in his convictions. Well, you know what? I want to be remembered for an uncompromising obedience to Christ. Nehemiah also wanted to be remembered for being trustworthy about the future. Let's wind this up. Start with me in verse 23. Read down through the end. Moreover, in those days, those bad old days, moreover, in those days, I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, or the language of one of the other peoples, and did not know how to speak the language of Judah. I rebuked them and called curses down on them, beat some of the men, pulled out their hair. I made them take an oath in God's name and said, "You are not to give your daughters in marriage to their sons, nor are you to take their daughters in marriage for your sons or for yourselves. Was it not because of marriages like these that Solomon, king of Israel, sinned? Among the many nations, there was no king like him. He was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. But even he was led into sin by foreign women. Must we hear now that you too are doing all this terrible wickedness and being unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women?" One of the sons of Joiada, son of Eliashib, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite. And I drove him away from me. Remember them, O my God, because they defiled the priestly office and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. So I purified the priests and the Levites of everything foreign, and assigned them duties, each to his own task. I also made provision for contributions of wood at designated times and for the first fruits. Remember me with favor, O my God. Nehemiah knew the past of Israel. He knew the history of the nation. How'd they get in this shape? He knew exactly how it happened. And he thought about the future generations. Do we want it to be good for them, or do we want it to be bad for them? Do we want those future generations to have it better than we have it now? We're slaves to a foreign king. Do we want them to have it better, or do we want them to have it just like us or worse? He had some really decisive actions here, didn't he? Beating people up, yanking hair out of their heads. That's pretty decisive. And making them sign a pledge. The reason he's so decisive is because lives depended on it. This wasn't a small thing. And I think we need to look ahead also. We need to think about the future generations. The land is littered with skeletons of closed church buildings. You know that? And you see them all over the place. You're driving down backcountry roads sometimes, and you'll see an old church building sitting there empty. Nobody's there. I had been a Bible study with a guy in Michigan, and a very intelligent man. Good dad overall, I think. He was a good dad. He didn't have a religious thought in his mind. His wife wanted him to go to church with her. She wasn't a very strong Christian. She wanted him to go with her. He wouldn't do it. And he, kind of against his will, agreed to study the Bible with me, and that didn't go anywhere, as you can imagine. But I did hear later on that his father, who had grown up in the church, but his father had fallen away, raised his family, and then after the family is grown, dad has come back to the Lord. He has repented and turned his life around. But see, it's too late because the children are already raised. And so dad now is calling this guy saying, "Don't do what I did. You're making a terrible mistake. I admit that I made a terrible mistake with you and your siblings, but don't make the same mistake I'm making." It's too late. As far as I know, that man is still not the slightest bit interested in religious things. I hope I'm wrong, but I haven't heard anything to the contrary. Future generations depend on our fidelity. They depend on us to be faithful and true. So we kind of have to look in the mirror and ask ourselves, well, can I be trusted with this? Fiduciary responsibility is really important. Fiduciary responsibility is, you know, the bank officer has a responsibility to treat your money well. It's not his, and he's take good care of it. And that's just one example. There are many people who have positions of trust, and they're supposed to be very responsible in the exercise of that trust. We are people of fiduciary responsibility. We have a trust that has been handed to us. That trust is the souls of children yet unborn. For us to teach and to practice the truth is not just for our benefit. It's for the benefit of the generations that will come behind us. And may they come and find that we have been faithful. When we first started talking about building this church building, we were so grateful to those who had planned before us and built that church building that we had. For all the problems that it had at that time, it had stood for almost 80 years and done very good service. So we wanted to build a building where generations from now, people would bless us for taking thought for them and thinking about what would be appropriate and helpful to this church to continue to grow and expand and do well through the years. We have a position of trust. Now, Nehemiah had a vision for the future of his people. And his commitment to that vision ensures that we remember him for all the right reasons. He did not want to be remembered for his ties to government, his friendship with the king, his influence back in Susa. He wanted to be remembered for his labor in a little backwater of the Persian Empire that nobody in power at the time cared the slightest bit about. Nobody cared but him. He wanted to be remembered for being the kind of person that he was. Not what he accomplished, but the kind of person. It wasn't the deeds, but the character that he wanted God to remember. And that kind of legacy is available to everybody who will name the name of Christ. Not the deeds, but the character is the important legacy. If we will be faithful and zealous for God, if we'll be uncompromising in our obedience to Jesus and trustworthy toward the future, we'll be remembered by God. We'll be remembered by God. Over in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 10, the writer says, "God is not unjust. He will not forget your work and the love you have shown Him as you have helped His people and continue to help them. You can leave behind a glorious epitaph. And I guess the greatest epitaph that anyone could write on a tombstone would be, Servant of the Most High God. It's the only epitaph we need. If you're not a Christian this evening, we're going to give you an opportunity to respond to the gospel message and obey it. You too can become a great servant of God, a faithful and zealous servant, uncompromising in obedience, mindful of the future. If you understand that Jesus is the Son of God, if you're willing to confess His name before men, to repent of sin, be immersed in water for the forgiveness of sins, raised to walk in newness of life like we're talking about this morning, you can do that and begin leaving behind a great legacy. If you're a Christian, though, and you've made the covenant with Christ in the past, but you haven't lived with Him, haven't lived for Him, haven't done His will, you're in the same shape as the people that Nehemiah was talking to. But it's not hopeless, you see. It's not hopeless, because Nehemiah turned the situation around and helped them to see what was really important. And you, too, can be restored to a right relationship with God and be the servant of the Most High God that you really want to be. If you need to respond publicly to Jesus' invitation, we urge you to do it right now while we stand and sing.